This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the Democratic presidential race in the wake of yesterday's big victory for Barack Obama in North Carolina and Hillary Clinton's narrow victory in Indiana. On overall points, if you were to score it, you'd have to say Barack Obama with a very big day. And as just as importantly to the Clinton campaign, she loses an opportunity to pick up ground and overall loses ground in her efforts to get the Democratic nomination. She was a long shot statistically coming in. This makes her effort even less likely to be successful. But should she continue in the race? Does she have the money to do so? She says she's going to keep on going. She's expected to win West Virginia next Tuesday, but we'll see what's in the cards, as it's expected pressure from within the Democratic Party may increase, pushing her to make a decision to drop out of the race. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who are supporters of Senator Clinton's. Do you want to see your candidate continue to fight on with the possibility that something might happen to Barack Obama's campaign? He might make a major misstep. Something might happen which would enable the superdelegates to change their alignment and support Senator Clinton. Or do you think it's time for her to throw in the towel? 866-893-5722. Sherry Babich-Jeffy is political analyst for KNBC 4 News and senior scholar at USC. Sherry, good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. Welcome to the KNBC newsroom.
Very good. We're glad to be in there with you. Well, at this point, do you think Hillary Clinton has only the very longest of shots, it would seem, at this point, given the gap and the few primaries left?
Well, if she has a shot at all, quite frankly, it will be something entirely outside of the process. It will be an external event, some kind of major shoe dropping that lands on Barack Obama's head, and that really is about it. Mathematically, she cannot catch him with regard to elected delegates. It just can't happen. She is running on fumes. Her campaign is almost broke. This morning, it was announced that she had again loaned her campaign money, $6.4 million in the last month. Fundraising isn't going as well as she might like it to be, and her major donors have tapped out. She's got an awful lot at this point going against her in the weeks coming up.
David Menefee-Leiby with us as well. He's professor of politics at Pomona College, one of the Claremont colleges. David, good to have you on board again.
Hi.
You agree with Sherry that at this point, really, the only thing that could allow Hillary Clinton to be the nominee is some complete meltdown in the Obama campaign?
Yeah, I think that's probably been true. I think Sherry and I would agree that it's been true for several weeks, but she really, this was her last gasp.
It.
I mean, Indiana, if she had won Indiana by 10 or 12 points, then it might have been plausible somehow that she could convince the superdelegates that Obama had really run aground after his sweeps in February, but he just didn't run aground.
All right. And, you know, as you look at the financial aspect of this, for the few primaries that are left, is she going to be able to buy, you know, any advertising to speak of at all? And he's only going to be able to raise more money on the heels of this, Sherry.
That's exactly right. And I heard this morning that she's actually cutting back on advertising in some of the six states that are remaining. I think she's even looking beyond the electoral part of the nominating process and is beginning to focus on the convention aspect of the nominating process. She's looking to the Rules and Bylaws Committee meeting on May the 31st, which will deal with the questions of Florida and Michigan, and looking beyond that. I think right now her major goal is to pressure the committee, of pressuring superdelegates, of course, pressuring the committee to seat Florida and Michigan, which will give her some delegates and will pad her popular vote total.
Well, I mean, the problem with that, though, is that means that it has to wait until the convention, right, David? And so, and party leaders say they don't want it to go that long.
That's the end of August, and you know, that narrows the window for the fall campaign down to about 2.5 months. They really don't want to be spending the last 10 weeks trying to sort of put together things that have been fractured and stayed fractured all the way through the summer. I mean, it really is. I mean, Obama has begun to send signals that he's willing to cut some kinds of deals with the Florida delegation in particular, so to try and find some way of seating those delegates and signaling to Florida that he recognizes their importance in the nominating process. And I think he's playing a hand from a very strong position now where he can be much more magnanimous about dealing with the rules in Michigan and Florida, because I think he's confident that there's no way that those will allow
Clinton to
take the nomination. Yeah.
The downside, though, they seat those delegations and give them voting power in the convention. That's going to open up the floodgates. California would probably look to move its primary, because the feeling's got to be, well, if the party's not going to enforce its rules, might as well move the primary even further forward, Sherry.
Well, I think, you know, states have very short attention spans, number one. Number two, I don't think they're going to in any way give back Michigan and Florida whole. What I'm hearing is one scenario being considered is to do what the Republicans did, and God knows why they didn't do that in the first place, which is to cut the number of delegate votes for each state in half. The other scenario, which is a little interesting, is to seat only the superdelegates from each state.
All right, because they'd be free to vote whatever
anyway,
they want to do anyway.
Exactly.
So,
David. Another piece of this, too, is though one of the things that's happened here is that, just to be contrarian for a second, what we've seen in the last 6 weeks is that Pennsylvania, that everybody was making a joke out of back in, you know, in November and December, that they had scheduled their primary so late that they wouldn't play any role in the nomination. And Indiana, and my goodness, you know, look at Oregon out there. I mean, people were thinking that by going late, they'd blown it. And instead, those states have shown that they're absolutely pivotal to the nomination process. I mean,
yeah,
the incentives are different now, that the states that go late really retain the possibility of having some influence in the nomination.
But what are the odds you're going to have another race
close?
Yeah,
exactly. Election cycle is unique.
That's a fair point.
In our kids' lifetime, maybe, but...
Yeah, that's right.
Sherry Babbage Jeffy and David Menefee Leiby, a political analyst with us on Air Talk. I'd like to hear from you, particularly supporters of Senator Clinton. Do you want to see her fight on and stay in the race despite the very long odds against her, or do you think it's time for the party to come together around Barack Obama's candidacy? Dennis in the Pico Union District, welcome to Air Talk.
Yeah, hi.
Yes, Dennis.
I don't think Hillary should get out of the race. I think that after Pennsylvania, the polls showed that she was behind in Indiana. They showed that she was way, way behind in North Carolina. She made up ground at least 15 points in North Carolina, and she won Indiana, right next to Obama's territory, Illinois. So she did really great. I don't know why you guys are talking about her doing badly.
Well, the fact is he won more delegates than she did yesterday. So, and she needed to win a lot more than him yesterday to show that she's poised to come from behind. So that's why we're talking about it in this statistical context. Sherry, your response, she's come from behind before.
Well, I mean, she has come from behind before and in the popular vote, but the delegate vote has always been close. And quite frankly, the polls just before the election in North Carolina had her coming up with only something like a 7% differential. I mean, one of the things I hope we have learned from this election cycle is don't bet the house on polls.
Yeah.
This is a very volatile electorate. It's a volatile political environment. What we have seen happen over a period of time is that as the results come in and we look at the exit polls, and this, I think, is reflected also in the polls, she has a constituency which has become more and more solid for her. He has a constituency, a different one, which has become more and more solid for him. So that middle, that swing middle does it, and you can't really always poll that.
Yeah, good point. You don't even necessarily know who is going to turn out. John in Santa Monica, you're on Air Talk. Hi, John. Nope. All right. We'll see if we can get him back on. Let's talk with Tracy in Hollywood. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi.
Hi, Tracy.
You know, I think just for myself, it was so exciting. The two candidates were so compelling and so strong early in the race. And then to now hear your analysis, the statistical analysis that says the math is darn near impossible, but Hillary Clinton's rhetoric is so in defiance of that reality that now my feelings for her are a lot more distasteful. I just feel like the rhetoric and the push damages her as well as Obama.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of just the fight continuing. So I just wanted to...
Okay, Tracy, I appreciate it. David, you want to respond to that?
No, I think that there's the level of contentiousness has really escalated a lot. I think that happened before Pennsylvania when really Clinton was playing for broke. I mean, her back was really against the wall. She had to win big in Pennsylvania, and she realized the only way that she was going to do that is to make a forceful case to people that there really were differences between those two candidates, and there really was a difference in what kind of a president she would be. And she's proven that she's got a very solid set of people who are supporting her. She doesn't need to be obsequious about this. I mean, she has a solid base here, and she can continue to advocate for that base, and she can carry that base into the convention and deliver it or not deliver it in the fall. And she's starting to signal now that she... I thought the speech that she gave last night was more focused on the issues that she's working on and the idea of Democrats uniting rather than attacking Obama. And there may be ways that she's signaling here that it's time to come together and to sort of mend fences between the two sides. And that was clear in Obama's speech as well in North Carolina, where it was a general election speech last night.
I was a little surprised, Sherry. I don't know if you watched Hillary Clinton's speech, but Bill Clinton standing behind her, he looked visibly distressed to me. And I was a little surprised, because I think of him as a good actor, that he wasn't able to look a little more upbeat.
This is a big loss for him. If you saw Chelsea, she also didn't look like she was having very much fun up there, and I think that was a clue that if they were going to go on, they weren't going to go on with it wholehearted. And I watched Senator Clinton's speech this morning coming from West Virginia, and it was a policy-laden speech, but there is something missing from her delivery and from her demeanor. It was almost as though she was walking through it, sort of marking time, if you will. And with regard to her speech last night, I think Matt Lauer on the Today Show got it absolutely right. He described the speech as schizophrenic. It was part victory speech and part concession speech. And you just don't know until she does it which one it was.
All right. Sherry Bebich Jeffy of USC and KNBC4 and David Menifee Leiby of Pomona College. I'd like to hear from you if you're a Clinton supporter. What do you think should be her next step? Do you want to see her stay in the race as long as she possibly can and try and take it to the convention for a decision? Or do you think she should drop out sooner rather than later? 866-893-KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the University of California, helping create California's next generation of innovators, delivering more than 10,000 babies a year through its medical centers, and pioneering breakthroughs like flood-tolerant rice to help feed a hungry world. UC, what state would we be in without it? Information at universityofcalifornia.edu.
Good morning, it's 10:19. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Mark Thomas, sitting in for Hedy Lynn Hurdies. A San Diego middle school is in lockdown as police investigate a report of an explosion inside a trash can at the school. Wagenheim Middle School in the San Diego suburb of Mira Mesa was put on lockdown just after 7:30 this morning. Police spokesman Gary Hansen tells the San Diego Union-Tribune that students already in the school are being kept in classrooms and those arriving for class are being kept outside. Well, a day after contract talks with the Screen Actors Guild broke down, Hollywood producers are now getting together with representatives of television actors to discuss a new contract. The Producers Alliance called the movie actors' demands on DVD sales online content unreasonable. Today, the smaller AFTRA, or American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, takes its turn at the bargaining table. For the latest traffic and weather, visit our website at kpcc.org. This is 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by City of Hope, helping to lead the way in less invasive surgery for lung cancer patients using the Da Vinci robotic system. Guided by skilled surgeons, Da Vinci helps remove tumors precisely for less discomfort and a faster recovery. If you have lung cancer, you can call 800-826-HOPE.
or you can ask your doctor for a referral. City of Hope, science saving lives.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Yesterday's primary results in Indiana and North Carolina, our topic of discussion with David Menefee-Leiby and Sherry Bebich-Jeffy. I'm asking Hillary Clinton supporters, what do you think should be her next step? Do you like her marching on, moving on to West Virginia, where the primary will be next week and where she's expected to win? Do you think it's important for her to be poised in case Barack Obama suffers some kind of misstatement that damages his career or something from his past that might come up and run his campaign off ground? Or do you think that it's better for her to leave the field at this point so the party coalesces around Barack Obama and he can totally aim his sights on the presumptive Republican nominee John McCain? 866-893-KPCC. Tom in Silver Lake, welcome to Air Talk. Tom, what do you think?
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I think that Hillary should most certainly stay in the race. I know the odds are increasingly against her, but the fact of the matter is at the end of the nomination process, the primary process, it's still going to be a very close pledge delegate count. I'm hoping that the superdelegates would then show their leadership and vote for the candidate that has the better chance of winning in November against McCain. And in my opinion, that would be most definitely Hillary Clinton.
Do you think, though, that the superdelegates would ever agree on one candidate? I mean, on that issue alone, if the superdelegates were all put into a room and you said, okay, who has the better chance against John McCain? My guess is they'd split.
Well, how about the big electoral states?
I agree.
The swing states, particularly the Ohio's, the Pennsylvania's, the Florida's, those definitely poll better for Hillary against McCain than Obama.
Sherry, quick comment on that.
That's an argument I hear over and over again, and quite frankly, it's comparing apples to oranges. You're talking about a primary election and a primary electorate. You're talking about a general election and a general electorate, and you're talking about an election that is still 6 months away. There's no way any poll today, head-to-head of anybody for the fall campaign, is useless. That's
David. David, your thoughts on this?
I think one of the things that we saw in Pennsylvania that was surprising to me was even when that became a very rancorous campaign, the matchups between Obama and McCain and Clinton and McCain kept on getting stronger and stronger for both Democrats. I mean, there's a way in which getting these candidates, these Democratic candidates out there, has made them stronger and has crowded John McCain off of the stage. And it's not clear. I mean, I understand that Hillary supporters will say they'll never vote for McCain or for Obama right now, and vice versa. But over that 6 month period, I mean, I don't see any signs that right now that McCain is going to be able to be competitive with those people in the fall. And Sherry's right; 6 month out polls are not very strong. But the fundamentals right now of this race are suggesting a very strong Democratic year in terms of voter registration and campaign fundraising and campaign recruitment and general
issues.
And issues. The public preference for the Democratic position on issues is very strong right now. And I don't think that the general election threat right now is foremost in the minds of the superdelegates. I think there's a great deal of confidence among those superdelegates that either Democrat can win in November.
Hillary Clinton is speaking in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and she has just said she is staying in the race until there is a nominee.
Well, so, that can be at any time.
Yeah, I mean, what does that
10
mean?
10 minutes
yeah,
from right. now.
Yeah, although, I mean, certainly the implication would be that until it's numerically decided.
Yeah. I mean, that
seems to be what she's indicating, is she's not going to the sidelines. Max, David, go ahead.
One other quick note. One of the things that I think is getting pushed off the stage here, too, is that on the other side of the aisle, I'm looking at the Republican campaign. I mean, McCain is still doing the business that we're talking about happening on the Democratic side here. He's still mending fences within his own party. In the past several primaries, there have still been 20, 25, 30% of these Republican primary voters who have voted for Huckabee and Romney and other candidates for the nomination. And McCain is still trying to consolidate his own base. He had to give a speech yesterday at Wake Forest University assuring conservatives that he would appoint conservative justices to the court. I mean, he's not able to reach out and take those centrist voters that some Democrats are worried they'll lose to him right now, and he's still working on his own base.
Let's take a listener call. This is from Max in Venice. Welcome to Air Talk.
Yes, hello. I was a huge supporter of Hillary until one day I got off the plane in Washington, D.C. and saw a T-shirt that said, "Anybody but Hillary." And it made me realize that all these Republican voters that don't necessarily like McCain will be out in force because they simply don't like Hillary. In the very same way, none of us who like John Kerry voted against George Bush. And I don't think you have a 16 years of backlash hatred against Barack Obama.
So your thought is that there might be Republicans who stay home and don't vote in the general election if Obama's the nominee, but will be sure to get out and vote for McCain if Clinton's the nominee?
Exactly. I think it's revenge for 8 years of Bill Clinton. It'll be just the hatred that Hillary's built up among far right wingers. I think that there will be a groundswell of the Stop Hillary campaigners.
David, what do you think?
There's a lot of that out there. I mean, we see that some of that in polls when we just do a general kind of thermometer of what your feelings are toward particular candidates. And she's had very high negatives for more than a decade now, I mean, going back into the 1990s. And that's a difficult thing for her to overcome. I think that she could overcome it if she were the nominee because it's a very strong Democratic year. But it is, I mean, the caller is right. I mean, that there is a residual long-term sort of visceral feeling about the Clintons in some quarters.
And there's a special new class of voters, Larry, which are called Obamacons, and they aren't figments of Obama's imagination. I have many friends who are Republican who are extremely dissatisfied with George W. Bush, who do not have trust in John McCain, and who quite frankly like what they see in Barack Obama. So I have a feeling, and I think the polls have indicated, that he could, for the Democrats, be a more significant draw of both independents and Republicans in the general election.
Maria in Burbank, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. Yeah, I think one thing that people are forgetting whenever they bring up that anything but Hillary stuff is that Bill won those two elections.
That's right.
Yeah. People he won two elections. I still, to this day, I'm not so sure that George Bush won two elections. Okay, and there are a lot of people out there just like me. So anytime somebody brings up the fact that the Republicans feel such hatred for Bill, that being said, there are a lot more people who love Bill and turn around and look at Hillary and see Bill standing behind her, literally.
Yeah, Sherry, what's your sense of attitudes about both Hillary and Bill Clinton?
Well, in some sense, you're talking more about Democrats than you are talking about Republicans. And I'm not really quite sure how that connects with what we've been talking about. I mean, Bill Clinton's presidency.
Well, she's saying despite the fact that Bill Clinton was a polarizing figure, he was still able to win.
That's true. But it is not only a matter of are you polarizing or are you not polarizing. Who is your opponent? What does the environment look like? He came in, quite frankly, if you look at where we are now, and particularly in terms of economic issues, it's not that much different than it was in 1992, and people lashed out against George Herbert Walker Bush. People didn't feel that he felt our pain the way Bill Clinton did, and the second time Bill Clinton won, it was for re-election, and it was for re-election against Senator Bob Dole. I'm not arguing one way or another. I just think you cannot base any kind of an interpretation of what we're going through in one election cycle on what we might have gone through on another.
Well, let me go back to Maria, because I wanted to ask you, Maria, whether you think that there's a difference in the polarizing impact of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, because my sense is that there was a lot of centrist support in the country for Bill Clinton, that he was a polarizing figure. I mean, conservatives absolutely hated him, but that for more centrist voters, that there was not that feeling. But my sense is that among even some centrist voters, there is an antipathy toward Hillary Clinton. Do you think that's true or not?
Well, it was funny because I was listening to your guest just speaking. I thought she's just making my two points. But when you say you can't compare two election cycles, that's all you have to compare them to.
No, you don't.
Of course there's
No. I'm not going to make an argument out of this, but that's a very narrow perspective.
Okay, Maria, the question I just asked you, do you think that there's a difference in the perception across the country between Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton?
I think it's the same dynamic. You're talking about how she's polarizing. He was more polarizing. Okay? And you're talking about the economy. Well, remember the economy was bad back then, and he was elected because he promised to do something about the economy. He had very specific, very boring by a lot of people's judgments, speeches about very specific details.
Okay.
And he was running against people who were all hearts and flowers.
David Menefee-Leiby. Okay, hold on, Maria. David Menefee-Leiby.
I think Maria's point is well taken. There is a lasting affection for Bill Clinton, especially among Democrats, but even among the general public. I mean, if you look at polling about him, people feel pretty good about looking back on his presidency. The issue that I think concerns Democrats in this is not so much the presidency as down ticket and down the ballot. And this is one of the things that the Obama people talked about a little bit in February and then backed off of it, which is to point out that, yes, Bill Clinton got himself elected and reelected, but remember that at the beginning of his presidency, the Democrats controlled Congress, controlled both chambers of Congress, controlled most governorships, controlled most state legislatures. And within 3 years, Republicans had taken over a large number of state legislatures. They'd taken over the Senate. They'd taken over the House. They'd taken over a lot of governorships. And Bill Clinton might have been good for Bill Clinton, but wasn't necessarily good for Democrats all the way down the ballot. And that's really what Obama was talking about last night when he was appealing directly as a partisan, where he said, you know, I'm a Democrat and this is what we can do for America. He was talking to those superdelegates, reminding them that he will campaign in the fall for people down the ballot and will bring out Democratic voters and will hang on to those state legislatures and will hang on to those House seats. And Bill Clinton was not able to do that during his presidency.
Let's talk with Janice in downtown Los Angeles. Welcome to Air Talk. You're on with David Menefee-Leiby and Sherry Bevis Jeffy.
Hi. My question and inquiry has to do with the nature of our non-winner-take-all primary system. The Democrats used to have a winner-take-all primary system, and the Republicans currently have such a system. I'm wondering whether an argument in favor of Hillary is that she would have won the nomination a long time ago had we had the system, given that she won all the big states which were very delegate rich.
Sherry,
the rules of the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Party indicate that's not the way the game is played. And in fact, there used to be winner take all primaries within the Democratic Party, and as part of the McGovern-Fraser Commission reforms post 1968 and the debacle at Chicago, the Democratic Party went from winner-take-all to what they perceive to be the more Democratic proportional representation. That's an argument that simply cannot be made.
Well, and I think the other...
somebody just because, what if?
Well, and the other issue is that I think there was so much feeling in the Democratic Party about when George Bush was elected, even though losing the popular vote, and the feeling, well, gosh, you know, how can the will of the people, you know, be overturned, one person, one vote kind of a thing. And so I think it'd be difficult for the party then to turn around
exactly.
And to use the same kind of, you know, rules as the Electoral College and do a winner take all.
Exactly, and I do think that is a debate within the Democratic Party. Now, I do think the decision makers within the Democratic Party realize that would be a very dicey debate to engage in.
Another small point that I'd make for
is
just that the campaign was fought and the nomination process has been fought under the rules that are there. And if the rules had been different, if there had been winner-take-all in those states, both Clinton and Obama would have conducted their campaigns differently.
Yeah, they would have totally done them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good
very
point,
good
David.
Point.
Yeah.
All media.
Yeah, would have been. And so then would his financial advantage have been helped him more than it has, or would Hillary Clinton have been on more of a level playing field?
Well, she certainly did very well in these very large states, as the caller has said and as everyone has said. I mean, and it's difficult to compete in those very large states without a lot of money because, you know, as we in California know well, I mean, we don't encounter the candidates face-to-face here. We see them on our TV sets, and you've got to be able to buy you know, advertising money. But again, you know, under different rules, you know, they might have been able to be to appeal to fund to contributors in a different way. It's sort of an imponderable to know what would have happened if the rules had been different.
Let's talk with John in Santa Monica. Welcome to Air Talk. Hi, John. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think she should stay in. She shouldn't quit, and I'm glad she said that today. I think the issue is who can win the swing states. And with all due respect, people, the talking heads particularly, have been trying to get her out of the race since Iowa. And she's been written off for dead many times. But if you look at the exit polling data from Indiana and North Carolina, she still has a significant problem with working class whites. Now, I don't think any Democrat's going to win North Carolina and Indiana. But if you go to Ohio and Florida and Pennsylvania, Obama is not closing the deal with those voters. So,
although he did do a little bit better last night,
deal with that part of the electorate. The real solution is twofold. First of all, seat all 50 states. Michigan split them 50-50. Florida seat them as the election result. And second, put these two on a ticket, because the two of them take the strength of all parts of the Democratic Party.
I think the problem is, you know, would she accept being the vice presidential one on that ticket? And the other thing is, how are Barack Obama supporters, you know, going to feel if he ends up with the most primary votes and then he takes the second position? I think that's a dicey compromise, David.
Well, it's happened before. I mean, Ronald Reagan put George H.W. Bush on the ticket after George H.W. Bush had ridiculed him through the entire nomination process for having voodoo economics. And John Kennedy put Lyndon Johnson on the ticket in 1960, when Johnson had been nothing but dismissive of Kennedy as a senator. I mean, there have been odd couples in the past that have surprised us all and have often won. I mean, I think that some of this, I'm sure these conversations are happening between the representatives of these two parties, you know, in hushed rooms somewhere, of trying to figure out, you know, who would be willing to accept what and what the terms of it would be. But I know that conversation is going on.
Well, and I mean, I can certainly see Barack Obama inviting Hillary Clinton to be his running mate, but Sherry, can you see him taking him up on that?
See her taking
him up on that, yeah.
I vacillate on that question, Larry. I'm not at all sure I understand why he would have to invite her onto the ticket. But quite frankly, if you were Barack Obama and you knew if you invited Hillary on the ticket, there might be a 50-50 chance she'd take the position. And with her comes Bill Clinton, who may perhaps overshadow you in the White House. Would you even ask her to take that position?
All right. Well, that gives us food for thought. Thank you both. A lot of fun talking with you. Thanks to our great callers for weighing in as we asked Hillary Clinton supporters to say what you want your candidate to do now. Sherry Bevis Jeffy of USC and NBC4 News, and David Menefee-Libby of Pomona College. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Cedars-Sinai Center for Minimally Invasive Gynecological Surgery, providing minimally invasive techniques to treat the full range of gynecological conditions like endometriosis, ovarian cysts, and fibroids, which can cause infertility and pain. Cedars-Sinai is one of the few centers in Los Angeles using these techniques. To make an appointment, you can call 1-800-CEDARS-1. 1-800-CEDARS-1. Cedars-Sinai, leading the quest for health.
It's 10:39. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Mark Thomas, and we've got a ticket giveaway, a pair of tickets for the performance of Susanna on Sunday, May 18th at 2 o'clock at the Orange County Performing Arts Center in Costa Mesa. Now, this is an all-American folk opera of raw emotional power. It's set in rural Depression-era Tennessee. It's a story of power, accusation, loss of innocence, and resolve that's told through music, which captures the American sound. And we're going to take the third caller, the third person to call, 626-585-7893, will win a pair of tickets for the performance of Susanna on Sunday, May 18th. Former President Jimmy Carter joins Pat Morrison live in studio this afternoon. Whether he's negotiating peace settlements between warring factions in third world countries or building homes in the U.S. with Habitat for the Humanity, it's hard to criticize Carter's work ethic. The former president has written a new book that chronicles the source of that ethic, his mother, Bessie Lillian Gordy Carter. And it's titled A Remarkable Mother. He'll discuss all those topics, plus the Democratic presidential race, with Pat coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock, right here at 89.3 KPCC. Quick look at traffic in Santa Monica, the 10 West at Centinella. Three cars have tangled in the two right lanes, and traffic will be slow from Bundy. And in Monrovia, the 210 West is slow from Myrtle to Rosemead. For the latest traffic and weather, visit our website at kpcc.org. This is 89.3 KPCC.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We continue talking politics and the initiative process, as well as what might be a pair of dueling initiatives on redistricting in California. As you recall, Proposition 93 was defeated by California voters in February. It's yet another attempt to come up with changes in term limits. That is an issue that had been linked with redistricting in California. Now, at least with one initiative pending and likely to qualify for the November ballot, supporters want to see a 14-member redistricting commission put together, and that commission would then end up drawing districts with the idea of making them more competitive so that you don't have such conservative Republicans and such liberal Democrats in all these districts, and with more centrist voters not particularly well represented in Sacramento. The organizers of that initiative, including Common Cause, say that they have collected 1.2 million signatures. They only need just shy of 700,000 valid signatures for it to qualify for the ballot. But also yesterday, Assembly Speaker Fabian Nunez proposed legislation that would similarly put redistricting in the hands of a commission. Rafe Sonnenschein is political scientist from Cal State Fullerton. He joins us. Rafe, thanks for being with us. What's behind the competing initiative that Fabian Nunez is proposing?
Well, it's kind of hard to figure, except that it's also a way that he would like to get some other things done, because his proposal would tie a relaxation of term limits and some campaign contribution reforms. But I think there's something else behind it, which is there's been a concern from some Democrats that the plan that's about to go on the ballot skews that commission a little bit in the direction of Republicans and independents at the expense of Democrats. So it's my guess is he's speaking up for the forces in the Democratic Party that would like to see a different plan, and that may foreshadow the argument against that initiative when it's on the ballot in November.
Is the biggest difference the composition of that commission?
I think that's the most important difference, is that the Speaker's Commission gives a greater role to elected officials in the choice of these members, but also gives fewer independents and more party people. But also, I guess it does have one virtue, which is that there's probably a greater chance that you'll get knowledgeable people on the commission that he's designed. Now, the trouble is, I don't think his is going to get onto the ballot. So, which is why I tend to think this is the first shot in the November ballot battle on the governor's initiative, arguing that it's going to be too much skewed toward business interests and Republicans.
So he's sort of going on the record as pointing out what he perceives as the deficiencies in the governor and the Common Cause proposal.
I think so. And, okay, you know, it's his last press conference as speaker, but it may be the foreshadowing or the first shot of a November ballot battle.
Bob Stern also with us, the president of the Center for Governmental Studies. Bob, your thoughts on the potentially dueling initiatives?
Well, of course, actually, there would be one initiative, which is the governor and Common Cause. The speaker's will be a legislative measure, not an initiative. Although it's a ballot measure, so it's the same thing. I think he's just trying to confuse the voters. He's not going to get a two-thirds vote in the legislature to put it on the ballot. But he's trying to, I think, torpedo the other initiative, which is being turned in, has been turned in yesterday. The signatures were turned in. His initiative, or his ballot measure, not initiative, covers term limits and campaign finance. The big difference is he has the legislative leaders appointing members to the redistricting commission. And the members they appoint, the eight members, the majority of those members have to vote for the redistricting plan. Even if all the other nine members vote for the redistricting plan, you need five members. So he's basically trying to get the legislature to continue to control redistricting, unlike the Common Cause and Governor Initiative.
All right. So this is, as you see it, yet another attempt of the legislature to not allow disinterested parties from drawing these boundaries.
That's right. They want to draw the boundaries. They want to pick the voters. They don't want the voters picking them. And what we saw in 2001 was exactly that. Not only one incumbent has been defeated since 2001, a congressman. So it's been a real incumbent redistricting this decade. You know, the courts did it in the 1990s and 1970s when the legislature couldn't agree, and we had very competitive elections. So an independent body would do a much, much better job than the legislature. We've been involved with the redistricting measure. I have to say that we helped Common Cause and the governor's office draft it. So obviously I'm on
that. So you have a stake in it, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, and you know, certainly it couldn't be any less competitive than it is. I mean, these seats, except for term limits, hardly ever turn over. Bob Stern, let's go on to talk about the initiative process generally, because you have reissued a study that's now completely updated, looking at what the impact of initiatives have been on California law and governance. What are some of the conclusions of your new study?
Yeah, we came out with our book, Democracy by Initiative, Shaping California's Fourth Branch of Government. We had issued the book in 1991, and we did update it. What we found is that the initiative process, 100 years old, it was 1911 when Hiram Johnson did it, before AM radio, before FM radio, before television, before the Internet, and we need to modernize the initiative process. What we've found is we should not be repealing the initiative process, but we should be improving the process. The voters, by a two-thirds margin, say they actually prefer the initiative process over the legislative process. That's sad. I used to work for the legislature. I'm very unhappy that the voters say that. But they do have more confidence in the initiative process. But they're also unhappy with the process. They say there are too many initiatives on the ballot, and the initiatives are too complex. So what we're trying to do is solve the problems that the voters have with the process, but not repeal the process.
Before we get into your suggestions for reforming the initiative process, Rafe Sonnenschein, do you agree with the analysis that the voters have, that this has some real advantages, particularly with a legislature that's as deadlocked on financial matters as this one, but that the initiatives are so confusing?
Well, I'm not sure what the voters are saying about the problems with initiatives. I think Bob is right, though, that the voters like the initiative. They may not always be aware of the flaws that they have to deal with. They sure don't much like the legislature or the state government. And, of course, the voters helped that along by enacting very strict term limits, which, and reducing the staff of the legislators back in 1990, and then come back and say, how come the legislature is unable to get anything done? But given all that, I think there might be a market for some of these changes, which I think are pretty good, if people don't see them as limiting the people's right in the initiative front, because that's where people will draw the line, probably.
So do you think that term limits is a limitation on the legislature getting things done because alliances can't be forged in that period of time, or there's not enough future payoff that can come for negotiations and deal-making? Why would that make a difference?
Well, it's everything. It's the lack of institutional experience, the inability to develop long-term expertise on an issue, and then the cutback and staff up there. I mean, people were so intent on punishing the legislators for their presumed sins that they took away the tools, namely experience and staff, that had California rated the number one legislature in the country for many years between 1966 and 1990. So, you know, it's a funny world we live in. I mean, you take away the tools to succeed and then say, my God, there's no success, and I guess we better do everything at the ballot box. Now, of course,
but if voters thought it was that great, that the legislature was so great, they wouldn't have supported term limits, right?
Right, but that was in a climate that had a lot to do with tax revolts and anti-politician feelings that may not have been shaped by any particular event going on in Sacramento. Politicians are always unpopular anyway. But it's like with any profession, it always helps to give people the tools to be professionally successful.
Bob Stern, you look at term limits and the reduction in staff size as being one of the biggest factors in the performance of the legislature?
Not really. We came out with another report on term limits before the ballot measure, Prop 93, was on the ballot. And we agree that term limits should be extended. But we don't. The big problem with the legislature, it takes a two-thirds vote to get things, major things, through the legislature, budget, appropriations, and so forth. By the way, it only takes a majority vote to have citizens pass an initiative. And the legislature, and very few initiatives, by the way, pass by a two-thirds vote. And the legislature basically is reflecting the people. So it's easier, actually, to get appropriations and major policies by the initiative process because of the majority vote than through the legislature and two-thirds vote. So that's the big problem, we think.
So in Democracy by Initiative, shaping California's fourth branch of government, as you refer to the initiative process, what changes, what tweaks need to be made in the process?
We think that the biggest reform that we're suggesting is that before an initiative goes on the ballot, it must go to the legislature first, and the legislature must consider it. If the legislature and the proponents agree that the legislature can pass a bill, then the initiative is taken off the ballot. If you recall, in February, we had Prop 91 on the ballot. The proponents were urging people to vote no on it because the legislature had solved the problem, but they couldn't take it off the ballot. We think about 15 to 25% of the time, the proponents of the legislature can work something out and take it off the ballot so that the voters have fewer initiatives they have to vote on. 75, 80% of the time, that probably won't happen. Then what we would allow the proponents to do is to amend their initiative and put the amended initiative on the ballot, improve the initiative. They've been through the legislative process. They've learned about their initiative. They can make their initiative better. They can draft it better. And so what we're saying is the amended initiative goes on the ballot. The voters get to approve it. And then the most controversial part, the part that Rafe might have some problems with and the people might have problems, we would let the legislature amend the initiatives after they pass, provided it's a two-thirds vote, provided it's in print 10 days, and provided it furthers the purposes. California is the only state in the country that doesn't let the legislature amend it unless the initiative says the legislature can amend it. About two-thirds of the initiatives now let the legislature amend it. We would allow all initiatives to be amended by the legislature. So that we're trying to make the initiative process more flexible. We're trying to reduce the number of initiatives on the ballot. We're trying to have better written initiatives, and we're trying to And then letting the legislature amend it means that fewer measures will be on the ballot afterwards.
Now, what would be an example of an initiative that might be amended through the legislative process, and why?
Yeah, I helped draft the Political Reform Act of 1974. It was about 15,000 words, dealt with campaign financing, conflicts of interest, and lobbying. It was a good initiative. The people voted approved it actually by 70%. We were one of the few first initiatives to let the legislature amend that initiative by furthering the purposes. The legislature since then has amended it 200 times. If we had not put that provision in, those 200 amendments would have had to go on the ballot and the people would have had to approve them. And the legislature has done lots of good things, has increased some of the disclosure requirements, has increased some of the amounts required to be disclosed, things like that.
So you're not
affecting amendments.
You're not concerned that it would be neutered by the legislature?
Well, some people would be. There are some people who are against this proposal, saying that they're worried that the legislature, we'll, of course, let them go to court. And maybe what we would say is they could get double their attorney's fees if they win. So, you know, some people are very wary of the legislature, and that's maybe the weakest part of our proposal in the sense of having the people approve it, but we also think it's an important part.
Rafe, what do you think?
Well, I actually think it's a good idea. I'm not sure the voters will. I think Bob is right that it'll be easier to persuade people to let things get fixed before it's on the ballot than afterwards, but actually I think it's not a bad idea at all. In fact, I think people should write these initiatives on the assumption that the legislature will carry them out and give some flexibility in how they're carried out, because that's what government needs to do. I do agree, though, that if you're looking for an Achilles heel politically, that will be one that, you know, people will be short of trust on, although I think it's actually not a bad idea.
Bob Stern, who's the constituency for this? I mean, who would put all the effort into gathering the signatures and putting an initiative like this on the ballot to reform the initiative process?
Yeah, you're right, Larry. It's probably going to take an initiative to reform the initiative process. Probably the legislature won't do it. Although, on Pat Morrison's show on Friday, the day we released our report, she was interviewing Governor Schwarzenegger, and I heard a little clip going to the airport that morning, and Governor Schwarzenegger said, we have to reform the initiative process. We need to get the Democrats and Republicans together to reform it. So I was very encouraged. We had contacted the governor's office, letting them know we were releasing the report. He comes on Pat Morrison's show and says we need to reform the process. So we're hoping with the governor's leadership that we can change the initiative process.
All right, let's take a listener call. David in Mission Viejo, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Could you add to the discussion the issue of paid signature gatherers, these people that are paid so much per name? It seems to me that if you had people who were behind the initiative gathering signatures rather than paying other people to do it, it would turn out to be more equitable.
Okay. I think that there is a constitutional issue, isn't there, at play, Bob?
Yes, there is, unfortunately. As I've said, if you have $1 million to $2 million, you can qualify anything on the ballot. It won't necessarily pass, but you can get it on the ballot. And that's because the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled you cannot ban paid circulators. I would love to be able to do it, but I have to follow the Supreme Court decision.
All right. Rafe, quick closing word on this. I know you have to run to class.
Well, I do think something should be done about that they've proposed to extend the amount of time so that amateurs can have a chance of gathering signatures. I also want to call your attention to the fact there's a proposal in here to have constitutional revision commissions created, and as an old charter guy, I'm a big fan of that. I do want to throw in a caveat, though, because they do talk about creating a constitutional convention in alternate decades, and I have to say, of all these proposals, and I love them all, that one fills me with trepidation because
really?
I think that would become a madhouse. I think a constitutional commission is long overdue to clean up this messy state constitution that has really a lot of ridiculous things in it that no one's taken a look at in many years.
So you're supportive of that? You think
of the commission, but not of a convention. Not of a convention where
it's just open to the world too.
Yeah, I mean, trust me, that'll be. Every issue you've got with initiatives, multiply it by 1,000 times. You'll find that in the Constitution. We won't have Washington, Jefferson, and Hamilton, I can tell you that much.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Rafe. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Running off to class, Cal State Fullerton Professor of Political Science and author of Los Angeles Structure of a City Government, Bob Stern. We have a caller, Tom in Glendale, wondering about having a legal review of an initiative before it's put on the ballot so it can be determined if it's constitutional.
That's a very good question. Some states do that. We think what we find, though, is that the states that do that get rid of some initiatives that are actually pretty good. Florida, for example, the court does that. They got rid of an initiative. The court declared an initiative unconstitutional because it had redistricting for Congress and redistricting for the legislature. They said that was a violation of a single subject. We think using the legislature, however, requiring the initiative to go to the legislature first, having the legislature consider it, having them pass something maybe, but then having the proponents be able to change is enough review of the initiative.
All right. Bob Stern, thanks very much. For folks who want to read a copy of Democracy by Initiative, where can they get it?
They can get it at cgs.org. They get the executive summary and chapter by chapter, so they don't have to download the full 400-page book all at once.
All right. Bob Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies, which put together Democracy by Initiative, Shaping California's Fourth Branch of Government, a completely revised edition more than a decade after the original. Bob, thanks. Good to talk with you.
Real pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
We appreciate it. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC in the second hour. Jonathan Cohn joins us from the New Republic. His book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. We'll tell you more about that, as well as a fun conversation we're going to have with you for our final half hour.